Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump and his daughter Ivanka's meeting today with Al Gore, who has been at the forefront of arguing for an urgent need to address the catastrophic effects of global warming, perhaps the most critical issue facing mankind, which Donald Trump has labeled a fraud. Michael Wehrer, a professor of law at Stanford University who is an expert on energy and environmental law and climate policy, joins us to discuss the mixed signals from the Trump transition, where he has a global warming denier in charge of the EPA transition and a former Koch Industries lobbyist in charge of the Energy Department transition, who is dedicated to reversing and rolling back policies and subsidies that promote green energy and renewables while keeping in place subsidies for coal, oil, and nuclear. Then we'll look into the political turmoil in Italy following a constitutional referendum that was a stinging defeat for Prime Minister Matteo Renzi and is widely seen as another populist political tantrum like Brexit and the election of Donald Trump, in which an angry and alienated public voted to upend the political order and take their chances on the chaos that might follow. Alexander Stiller, a professor of international journalism at Columbia University and author of The Sack of Rome, How a Beautiful European Country with a Fabled History and a Storied Culture Was Taken Over by a Man Named Silvio Berlusconi, whose latest book is The Force of Things, Marriage in War and Peace, joins us. We will discuss this upset victory by a former clown, Beppe Grillo, who has called for a new election within a week. Then finally, we'll assess the nomination of Dr. Ben Carson to be the Trump administration's head of HUD, Housing and Urban Development, where the former neurosurgeon with no government experience will oversee an agency with an annual budget of $47 billion. Ronnie Dunn, a professor of urban studies at Cleveland State University, joins us to discuss a man whose only background in housing has been to oppose attempts to desegregate public housing as failed socialist experiments, and real estate deals with a convicted fraudster, Alfonso Costa, who heads up Carson's charity and manages his real estate investments. And joining us now is Michael Wehrer, who's a professor of law at Stanford University and a research fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. An expert on energy and environmental law, his research focuses on climate and electricity policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Wehrer.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And it's an odd contrast, I would say, or mixed signal that today Donald Trump and his daughter Ivanka met with Al Gore, who's probably the leading exponent of the urgent need to deal with global warming, man-made climate change. And yet the head of Donald Trump's transition team for the EPA is a global warming denier. And the head of the transition team for the Department of Energy is a former Koch Industries lobbyist who has been dedicated to rolling back subsidies that promote green energy and renewables. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think one thing that I conclude is that it is very hard to predict what is going to happen with so far as environmental and energy policy goes under Trump administration. Certainly the individual, Thomas Pyle, who's been chosen to run the energy transition, is an avowed foe of renewable energy, of renewable fuels, a whole variety of the carbon taxes, and a friend to the oil and gas industry. And that's kind of consistent with what Trump has been saying really throughout his campaign. On the other hand, you know, we see a lot of sort of inconsistent messages coming out of the Trump camp when it comes to climate. First, the statements that Ivanka Trump made a few days ago, and then today, the meeting with Al Gore. And it's really hard to know whether that's sort of being managed for sort of spectacle value. Some of this transition feels a little bit like a reality TV show, or whether it signals some sort of moderation in the positioning of the White House to be on climate-related issues. And I think we're just going to have to wait and see.
Well, the mixed signals, though, so far, you could argue that maybe some of the people that he's looking at for Secretary of State aren't dreadful, whereas a lot of them are. You know, I mean, arguably Mitt Romney is okay and General Petraeus, but then you got John. On the other hand, you got John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani. So even within those rare cabinet appointments where there's somebody that's at least a little bit more rational and experienced, the jury's still out on how he's going to go on that one.
Absolutely, and I think the other thing to say is that, you know, it really depends whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, or how you evaluate these sort of mixed signals really depends on what your baseline is, right? That the last 8 years have been a time of enormous progress for international climate diplomacy, led principally by the United States. And they've been a time of enormous progress domestically when emissions have fallen, even as we've recovered out of the Great Recession. And that's largely been because of a lot of innovation in renewables, also in the natural gas sector, right? The move away from coal and towards natural gas as a key fuel for generating electricity has driven down emissions to some degree as well. You know, where if your expectation is that trend was going to continue, you know, this is no Trump administration is going to meet that expectation, I think. If you were taking Trump at his word during the campaign, and particularly as he's talked about various leadership posts in EPA and his perspective on the Paris Agreement and on the Clean Power Plan, you know, these are sort of modestly positive developments where he seems to be backing away from some really destructive actions. I think it really remains to be seen what he actually decides to do. And personnel is policy. And so far, he hasn't actually made the key appointments at the agencies of the individuals that are going to set the agenda in detail. And if there's one thing I think it's safe to conclude about the Trump presidency, it's that he's going to delegate a lot to agency heads. He's not someone who's going to want to get into the details of, you know, power plant regulation. And so who those heads are is really going to matter. Who is the administrator of the EPA? Who actually is the Secretary of Energy is a very important question. We just don't know the answers yet. Who is the Secretary of State, as you were suggesting, right? A Romney international diplomacy is going to be very different than one developed by John Bolton, for example.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Werra, who's a professor of law at Stanford University and a research fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. He's an expert on energy and environmental law, and his research focuses on climate and electricity policy. So I guess, though, when you talk about a baseline, the real issue then in a nutshell is, are we going to have somebody in charge of the EPA and the Energy Department who's going to take us forward to meet these urgent challenges of climate change, or are we going to have somebody that takes us backwards? And certainly if you look at the record of Thomas Pyle and the work that he's done through these think tanks, you know, he's a former lobbyist for Koch Industries, and his think tanks have been funded by Koch Industries, the Institute for Energy Research, and the American Energy Alliance. And basically, he has, you know, he's got almost a personal war against Elon Musk, who, as far as I can tell, is this kind of an entrepreneur that we should, in this, particularly in our, you know, the capitalist culture of America that we celebrate, he should be a hero, you know, and yet they vilify him and all the green energy projects and keep talking about Solyndra all the time as though everything that has happened in terms of alternative energy has been a boondoggle. At the same time, they're perfectly happy to throw money at coal, which Wall Street's abandoning, for, as you mentioned, for natural gas and nuclear and oil.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. There's a real tension in the organizations that Thomas Pyle has been affiliated with over time between a sort of conservative support for markets and letting markets work and letting winners win and losers lose, and a desire to subsidize what I would characterize as old energy and remove subsidies for new energy. You know, the The interesting thing is that a lot of these organizations propose rolling back all sorts of subsidies that are there, sometimes appropriately, sometimes inappropriately, right? I mean, let's be fair, for new technologies or even not so new technologies, but that are clean energy alternatives to especially coal-fired electricity. And the PILS organizations have supported rollbacks of all of those subsidies, but do not mention rolling back the extensive subsidies that exist for oil and gas and for coal and for nuclear energy in the United States. And the reality is that where markets exist today, where there are really free markets for electricity in particular, renewables outcompete all the other technologies, with the possible exception of natural gas, where there's sort of a tie right now, but all signs point to renewables winning that race as well within the next couple of years. So if one is really free market, then that would support sort of rolling back all the subsidies and then maybe pricing carbon and saying let everyone compete on a level playing field where they have to account for the damages they create in the world, but don't get additional freebies from the government. That's not the position that the American Energy Alliance supports, at least so far as I can tell. And so it really does seem to represent sort of the old energy industry kind of fighting a battle to maintain its privileges in the face of new competition.
Well, the scary part is that, you know, there's this fellow Steve Bannon who a lot of people are very concerned about because of his dalliances with white supremacists and white nationalists, and he's Donald Trump's strategic advisor. He owns Breitbart News, and the House and Senate Energy Committee's heads, both of whom are global warming deniers, have been publishing as policy papers and putting up on their website global warming denying insanity from Breitbart News.
Well, I haven't seen the websites, but I think that there are many many folks in Congress who, even on the Republican side, people who will not come out and advocate publicly for regulation of greenhouse gas emissions, but who do recognize that the science is correct, that the climate is changing, that we are changing the climate by our actions, by burning fossil fuels in the quantities that we do. And the unfortunate reality is that the politics don't support those positions in many parts of the country, and that saying those things in many parts of the country results in a primary challenge from the right for many of these people. And so I think part of what we have to do, folks who support action on climate change, is to create a reality on the ground, change that political reality, continue working to change the conversation, to shift the political calculus for the folks that are in office. Because it's certainly the case that when times were different, you know, for example, when Waxman Markey was in the House, this is the cap and trade bill that failed ultimately to pass because it couldn't get 60 votes in the Senate, but it was a time when it was much less acceptable to deny the science of climate change, and the number of people that adopted those positions were far fewer in Congress on the Republican side. And I certainly think that politicians are very sensitive to the political winds, and so the thing that voters and citizens can do that's most effective is to work to change that the wind, change the political wind, change the sense that these representatives have, that's the best position for them to adopt. I don't actually think that many of the people who are elected to Congress, there are a few that really believe this, but I think many of them adopt this view as a matter of convenience because they think that climate change is a low priority issue for their voters, and they might be right about that. I mean, let's be fair. And
it wasn't even mentioned in the debates,
exactly.
Either by Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump.
Exactly. And you know, I think the legislators feel that the Congress people feel that they can get away with saying this stuff because it's not a top priority issue. So making it a top priority issue, speaking about it, forcing congressmen and other congresswomen when they get up in public to talk about it, whether they want to or not, is key to changing this conversation. And I think also linking it to values that are shared really across the country, right? Linking it to questions of innovation and jobs and economic development is really important. And certainly, you know, that's the way the Chinese see the issue, right? Our biggest competitor looks at climate change and says, that is the biggest economic development opportunity I have ever seen. And we need to create more of that dynamic in this country. And once we do that, those people are going to stop denying the science of climate change.
Well, Michael Werra, when you mentioned the winds of change, there's certainly the winds in Iowa are being used for wind energy on a very, very fast-growing scale. And one of the big champions, of course, is the conservative Republican Congressman King, who's a champion of wind energy. So it's not like all Republicans are denialists, as you've pointed out. But on the other hand, the science, the more you hear about the science, almost on a daily basis, about global temperatures and records being broken in the worst possible way, and the possibility of reaching the threshold where the self-reinforcing effects of methane release will almost doom us. You wonder what the conversation was in Trump Tower today between Donald Trump and Al Gore.
Yeah, well, certainly Al Gore is someone who for a long time has felt a deep sense of urgency about this issue. And, you know, the more years that pass, the more urgent it gets, because once we emit carbon dioxide, it's basically up in the atmosphere permanently, so far as, you know, any kind of decision making that we're taking today is concerned. So it's a real concern that we are going to waste 4 years, not get much done on this issue. But I think in the long run, there's a lot that we can do, both in terms of freeing up markets where fossil energy is basically protected, you know, letting solar compete. You know, there have been a lot of encouraging signs there. There was a ballot initiative in Florida that the utilities had put up basically to keep rooftop solar out of Florida, didn't pass, despite $25 million of funding from Florida Power and Light. And, you know, there are a lot of encouraging signs, especially when the conversation is about innovation and new kinds of energy and increasing choices for consumers, where they don't just have to take whatever kind of electricity at whatever cost is served to them by their monopoly utility. They have choices. The same goes, I think, in the medium term for electric vehicles as the prices are falling and as new more moderately priced vehicles are finally getting to market that have, you know, reasonable ranges that make them comparable to conventional cars. And so I think the trends are very positive. I do agree. I do worry that we are going to cross some pretty frightening thresholds as we, you know, move in the right direction, but not as quickly as we should. And the one I actually worry the most about is sea level rise, where there are a number of really troubling developments in the science around, especially the West Antarctic ice sheet, where we just don't know what's going to happen anymore. And that is likely to have enormous societal impacts that will play out over many decades. But we're making the commitment now. So I certainly wish that we had a different politics of climate in this country. We're pretty unique internationally. When you go to a conference of the parties, to the Framework Convention on Climate Change, you know, people want to talk to U.S. Folks at those conferences just to try to understand how it's possible that conservatives in the United States say what they say and believe what they do about climate change. Because it's really nowhere else in the world do conservatives feel that way. They might say, we don't want to spend a lot of money on this, or it's not, you know, it's the science is real, but it's not the most important thing that we have to deal with this, you know, this congressional cycle. But they don't deny the science, and that's a uniquely American phenomenon. And it's unfortunate, and it really does limit, in the short run, what we can do. I mean, the one other positive thing I would say is just that the polling suggests that the younger generation is not skeptical about climate science across the political spectrum. You know, conservative, very conservative Republicans who are young have completely consistent views about climate science with relatively liberal younger voters. Very different than the picture for folks that are my age and older.
Sure, that would explain Ivanka Trump, perhaps, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. She's a great example of this, where, you know, what seems reasonable to perhaps to her father seems completely outrageous to her.
Well, we can only hope, though. We don't know. But the bottom line here is, will we have to wait for the seawater to be in Donald Trump's front yard at his estate in Florida, or just in the last minute, say, what's going to happen to all of these promising Energy Department projects like the solar energy thing they have out in the desert out here in California, battery research, which is showing some great promise? Do you think that's all going to be frozen?
Well, I think the federal government for the next few years is going to play a smaller role. And, you know, with respect to a lot of this work, though, that also provides an opportunity for states that are willing actors, like California, to step up to the plate and assume a leadership role. And I would just point back to a time during the George W. Bush administration when, for religious reasons, Bush directed that no federal funding could be dedicated to stem cell research. And California said, okay, but we believe in science here, and we don't share the same religious views that the Bush administration has adopted as federal policy. And so we're going to fund stem cell research at California universities. And we did, and it was an incredibly successful program, and it gave our researchers a real leg up on the rest of the country when ultimately the rest of the country came to its senses. And we had developed real centers of excellence in research in the area. So I think we need to think like that about clean energy for the next couple of years.
Well, Mark Awera, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Awera, who's a professor of law at Stanford University and a research fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. He's an expert on energy and environmental law, and his research focuses on climate and electricity policy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the political turmoil in Italy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alexander Stiller, who is the San Paolo Professor of International Journalism at Columbia University. He's the author of Benevolence and Betrayal, Five Italian Jewish Families Under Fascism, Excellent Cadavers, The Mafia and the Death of the First Italian Republic, and The Sack of Rome, How a Beautiful European Country with a Fabled History and a Storied Culture was Taken Over by a Man Named Silvio Berlusconi. His latest book is The Force of Things, A Marriage in War and Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Stiller.
Thanks for having me.
And obviously, all of Europe is in a state of shock. Not that they haven't had the Brexit shock earlier, but the sound defeat of Matteo Renzi, how does it strike you? Is this another example of kind of populism gone mad like we've just experienced here in the United States with Donald Trump?
They are related. Every country, of course, has its own particular dynamic, but they are, let's say, part of a kind of family picture in the same way that cousins may resemble one another but have different personalities. These different developments, Brexit, the Trump election, the failure of Renzi on this referendum are a part of a particular moment of popular frustration, anger at the traditional governing parties, and uneasiness over globalization, trade agreements, similar kinds of things. You know, in this case, there are particular elements to it in that what was actually at issue in this referendum really didn't have to do with, like the Brexit, with falling of borders or encouragement of international trade. The issues involved were fairly technical institutional reforms of the Italian system. But Matteo Renzi, I think, made a kind of strategic mistake by making this a kind of referendum on himself. And he early on in the process announced that he would resign if the referendum failed, thinking that that by raising the stakes it would improve the chances of the referendum success. It backfired on him because it became a weapon to attack him, and it helped to galvanize the opposition to the referendum. But the main party behind the referendum, which is the Five Star Movement, is in many ways has a lot in common with the Leave position in the UK, to some degree with the Trump movement in the US. People who are uneasy about Italy's relationship to the EU, the Five Star Movement is in favor of Italy's leaving the European Union. It has been popular with young people in the way that the Bernie Sanders movement in the U.S. was, but also with disgruntled working class people who are more conservative along the lines of the Donald Trump movement.
Well, it seems, though, that at least the fact that Renzi wanted to reorganize a dysfunctional political system, the fact that that was seen as a power grab, that seemed like a big factor, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, one could have a complex discussion about the merits and demerits of his proposal. To put it in the most simple of terms, it would have reformed the Italian system away from being a kind of bicameral system in which both the House of Deputies and the Senate were sort of equal partners in the crafting of legislation with the ability to block legislation. And it would have made it a unicameral system for all but certain kinds of votes. So the idea was then to streamline things. But there were reasons to be uneasy about that didn't have to do with uneasiness about Renzi. It's a complicated question. I don't know that, I think many people were uneasy about the reform. It was not clear why that particular solution was favored by Renzi over many ways in which the Italian system might have been reformed. So the questions at stake were complicated, but it ended up being, as I said, sort of reduced for many people to Renzi yes, Renzi no. And, you know, I don't know that people were in most cases responding in a complex way to the issues that were at stake in the referendum itself.
So just going back to your previous book about Berlusconi, it feels like one wrecking crew after another. And if the person that's going to succeed Renzi is his professional background is as a clown, how are we to have some confidence? I mean, if the euro's tanked as a result of this, the shares in Italian banks are dropping like a stone, and the economy in Italy is 12% smaller than it was when the financial crisis began in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are reasons to worry. I myself don't have a great deal of confidence in Beppe Grillo is a very strange guy. in some ways, like somebody like Donald Trump, with zero political experience, a talent for exciting people rather than for formulating policy, a master of a kind of new sort of political language rather than of you know, political policy, and playing to people's fears rather than to you know, offering convincing solutions for the future. So there are reasons to worry. There are also certain authoritarian traits in his behavior, as there are with Trump, which are troubling and worrisome. The use of very sort of, you know, both vulgar and violent language. He was referring to Renzi during the campaign as a serial killer, which is, to put it mildly, an exaggeration. And that kind of thing. So there are reasons to be worried. I think that, you know, the larger issue is that Europe as a whole needs to really reassess where it's going. It needs to, you know, Europe has suffered enormously from the failure to dig itself out of the 2008-2009 financial crisis. That was clearly a factor in the Brexit vote. It will certainly be a factor in the French vote, which is coming up, and very much of a factor for the Italians as well, also in the U.S. So I think the, you know, the need to, I think the failure on the part of the EU to have an honest discussion after the Brexit vote and try to understand what went wrong and how to place Europe back on a course of growth is something that is overdue. And it's also unfortunate because Renzi, for all of his faults, is a very talented political leader and seemed to represent the best hope for the Italian center-left. The Italian right is very fragmented, and Berlusconi's party has kind of collapsed with his age and failing health. And so the right is kind of split between a xenophobic Northern League and the Grillo people. Neither are very reassuring presences. So we'll have to see whether the center-left can reorganize, whether Renzi is talked out of his resignation by the President of the Republic, who has to decide on what the next steps will be. But it's a very cloudy and worrisome situation.
Well, let's sort of turn the question inside out and ask what keeps Italy together, given that people tend not to pay taxes and the government is dysfunctional. And I think Renzi was right in trying to stop the power of the Senate for blocking everything and anything. And in general, given the recent history of the misrule by people like Berlusconi, you wonder what does hold the country together?
Well, Italy certainly is a country with major problems, but its elements of dysfunctionality can be overemphasized. Italy has a well-trained, highly educated population. It has thousands of excellent, very competitive businesses. It has a lot of resources that you associate with highly successful countries. The problem is that it has a political system that hasn't served it especially well, although even that can be overemphasized. You know, the health system in Italy is pretty good. The education system, despite everything, is pretty good. But too many resources are wasted. The south of the country is much more dysfunctional than the rest of the country. You know, many of the regions of North and Central Italy are among the most prosperous and pleasant places to live in the world, but that prosperity and functionality is unevenly distributed. And Italy has left a lot of those sort of problems untended, the problem of the South in general, the problem of public administration, which interferes into the economic life of the country too much, presenting opportunities for corruption and inefficiency, patronage systems, and so forth. But everything is relative. That, you know, those sort of elements of corruption and dysfunctionality also coexist with considerable resources for the country.
Well, apparently the other factor that was important in this election was the immigrants coming in from Africa in particular, many of whom drown on their way, but nevertheless they are flooding into Italy, and this is creating a backlash, is it not?
Yeah, how that, of course, that was nowhere on this referendum, but was part of a kind of general public uneasiness. In fairness, the Italians have done a pretty good job dealing with an impossible situation. This is a case where I think the European Union as a whole has grave responsibilities. They have left it to the border countries, Italy and Greece in particular, to contend with the exodus of millions of people, some political refugees, some economic refugees, flooding out of the Middle East, out of sub-Saharan Africa, out of North Africa, and heading on rickety boats to places like Italy and Greece. The onus for dealing with has been left entirely in the hands of the countries most immediately affected. The Europeans failed to, and this I think was part of the Brexit vote, to come up with a kind of coherent, unified strategy. Okay, so can Europe absorb 500,000 people per year? Should there be a process for sifting through and deciding which people will be accepted and not, which countries will take them, assessing their educational and work qualifications? That whole sort of process never happened. As a result, was sort of left to fade into chance, and the result is you get these, you know, desperate boatloads of people who are trying to work, find their way into Europe one way or another, instead of there being some kind of systematic process for dealing with the problem.
Well, the other thing that Italy has in common with Greece is the country's debt-to-GDP ratio, which is at 133%, which is, you know, second only to Greece's in the Eurozone. And the Italian banks apparently are, in some of them are in very dire shape, particularly the Banca Monte di Paschi di Siena. So in this period sort of a flux and uncertainty, after the defeat of Renzi, and as you mentioned, Alexander Stila, the president is still trying to get him to reconsider his resignation or his promise to resign.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got political uncertainty on top of economic uncertainty, that is anybody going to deal with the banking crisis?
Well, you know, I don't know, you know, the technical part of what would be required to deal with that. Part of that, of course, is psychological after a shock of this kind. Some of the banks are very weak. The Sienese bank you mentioned, the Monte dei Paschi in particular. Again, this is an area where better coordinated action from Europe would be required. And I think if Europe is going to hold together and survive, it needs to act in moments of when single member countries are in trouble. When, you know, the real estate market in the U.S. collapsed, there were particular states like Florida and Nevada that were especially affected. And it was uncontroversial that the rest of the country would accept making higher than usual unemployment benefits and, you know, other kinds of temporary assistance to these parts of the country that were hit particularly hard. Europe has not made that decision, but it needs to think about it if we don't want to have these kinds of crises that Greece, Spain, Italy have presented.
Well, Alexander Stila, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Stila, who is the San Paolo Professor of International Journalism at Columbia University. He's the author of The Sack of Rome, How a Beautiful European Country with a Fabled History and a Storied Culture Was Taken Over by a Man Called Silvio Berlusconi. And his latest book is The Force of Things, A Marriage in War and Peace. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the nomination of Dr. Ben Carson to be the Trump administration's head of the Housing and Urban Development.
that nobody is escaping to Desolation Row.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ronnie Dunn, who's a professor of urban studies at Cleveland State University, whose research focuses on social policy, racial profiling, racial inequity, and the criminal justice system, and issues affecting children and families living in urban areas, minority populations, and the urban poor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ronnie Dunn.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And, Ronnie, the idea that Donald Trump is nominating Dr. Ben Carson to head up the Housing and Urban Development Department of the government does feel like putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank, in as much as Ben Carson, first of all, he said that he has no government experience and he's never run a federal agency. His only experience in real estate is going into business with a guy that was convicted of pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit health insurance fraud, a retired dentist named Alfonso Costa. So, I don't know. I mean, this just feels like an insult.
Yes, I would agree. As you stated or alluded to, Ian, Carson is woefully unqualified for this position. To my knowledge, his only experience dealing with housing in if any sense other than the experience you just referred to or any qualification would be the fact that he lived in Detroit. So I guess that alone qualifies you to be the Secretary for Housing and Urban Development. So it is an affront to assume that automatically I take it that he's black and then he came from the inner city, thus he's qualified to deal with these issues of housing for low-income and elderly residents and disabled residents. So it is, in fact, an affront and as you said, it is like putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank.
Well, but he's an ideologue, this guy. It doesn't matter whether he's black, brown, or purple. He's an ideologue who believes in this kind of socialist conspiracy. And in these presidential debates, he laid out some of the wackiest ideas about how the communists are taking over America. So he believes, apparently, that housing and urban development is a massive socialist failure. So, you know, the idea of this man being in charge of a $47 billion budget for this agency that's supposed to serve people, I don't know. I mean, what was Trump thinking? Trump's the guy that was out there on the campaign stump talking about how much he cared about the African Americans living in the inner cities in a state of horror, the way that he described it.
But this just shows the level of disconnect and a lack of understanding that Trump actually has relative to the African American community. If you recall, every statement he made suggested that blacks all lived in the inner city and that his comments were disparaging and they were an affront to the African American community. So this is just more evidence of that. To assume if I appoint this individual, this black, and put him over, I guess this is going to be his urban policy for urban America, primarily through HUD. And as far as that might be the extent of his outreach to the African American community or efforts to address those issues, other than, as we know, on the criminal justice side, the potential implementation of stop and frisk. So.
Well, but he's already made statements against the affirmatively furthering fair housing, which he said is government overreach. And that comes out of the 1968 Fair Housing Act.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, how could you, as an African-American, deny the history of oppression against the African-American people in this country? I mean, that's just a part of it. I mean, housing discrimination wasn't that long ago, by the way, that covenants in all real estate around the country said no Jews. So, you know, blacks were way down on the list as far as that's concerned.
Absolutely. As you state, there's this recent history of the use of racial covenants. The African-American community, the majority of us, have been scratching our heads wondering just the question that you raise: how can a person of color, an African-American themselves, deny this history of oppression in this country? So Ben Carson has been an anomaly for many of us since he delved into the political arena and a lot of the positions and statements that he has made. So this is a travesty, this appointment, but it sends a clear indication as to where Trump's priorities are relative to housing and urban development. Obviously, they want to eviscerate these programs, this program in particular, and I can only imagine it's going to have dire detrimental effects and consequences for public and fair housing policies in this country.
So the idea of this man being in charge of this $47 billion project, it goes to the general strangeness of all these anti-government Republicans being put in charge of government departments. You know, they believe that the private sector should take care of everything, and they want to break and destroy government. And the Republicans have done a good job through imposing gridlock for the last 8 years during the Obama administration. So that's when I say this is an example of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank. You have to put it in the context that that's pretty much been the Republican Party policy, and certainly the Koch brothers are urging them on and writing them checks to basically ruin and break government so that private enterprise will have an open field. So the broader issue, I think, is, to my mind, is this kind of anti-government culture. So, you know, it's not the first time that somebody's been put in charge of a government department when they're absolutely, completely hostile to the very mission of that department.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So, once again, this goes back, it reminds one of Nixon's policies of benign neglect as it pertained to the implementation of civil rights legislation and policy. So, I anticipate that Carson will go about dismantling HUD and the very programs that were put in place to provide the housing of the low-income and disabled and elderly population as well. So but it's in line with, as you said, the dismantling of government and social programs in particular.
Well, isn't there also another way to look at Ben Carson? And it certainly became clear during his presidential campaign, where he was among the 17 on stage that in this reality show known as the Republican presidential nomination, where Donald Trump knocked them off the island one after one, and he ended up as the victor there. But he actually went pretty lightly on Ben Carson, and Ben Carson certainly didn't go out of his way to antagonize Trump, which is a very easy thing to do. But the thing that struck me was, in the middle of his campaigning to become president of the United States, the guy goes off on a book tour with his buddy and business manager, Armstrong Williams. So you've got these two African-American right-wing entrepreneurs, or even hucksters, I think would be the more accurate way to put it, because they have a pretty checkered business career and they've invested in a bunch of sleazy scam operations. My sense is, Ronnie, if you want to get ahead in politics and you're an ambitious African-American with no scruples, join the Republican Party, because they'll welcome you. There's too many African-American Democrats, for God's sake, you know, and they'll put you right up in front of the camera and they'll make a big fuss over you like you're one of them. And, you know, this is the part that I'm suggesting here, that these guys, they're very cynical, because, you know, they wouldn't be noticed if they were Democrats.
No, absolutely, absolutely. You're absolutely correct. Unfortunately, there has always been those African Americans or persons of other racial or ethnic groups that are willing to seemingly go against the interests of their larger community or the community that they come from for coin. And that appears that might be the case in this instance. Once again, Ben Carson, he's an anomaly, and it defies logic to try to explain the mindset or rationale of an individual like that. Personally, from my perspective, I find it very difficult to try to provide logic to the illogical or irrational actions of such individuals.
Well, his story, which he made a lot of, and so did most of the press, you know, the sort of rags to riches, you know, he's brought up by his mother, and his books are all about how he overcome poverty and became successful, and, you know, the Horatio Alger myth, and he's a perfect
right.
example of it, and he made very much of it. And frankly, you know, you can always sort of honor people for that. But my sense is that one of the reasons why his books became bestsellers was the people who were buying those books were white Americans, not black Americans. They don't necessarily identify with the idea that poverty is their fault, which is the subtext of everything that Carson has talked about, you know, that both the government's creating a culture of dependency. It's pretty much like what Mitt Romney said, you know, the country's divided between makers and takers. And you guys in the African-American community are a bunch of takers. I think you could make the real case where a guy like Steve Mnuchin, who Trump has nominated for Secretary of the Treasury, he's the ultimate taker. He kicked 40,000 people at least out of their homes and forced foreclosures on them and took all this government money as a reward for turfing people out of their homes and having them live in cars and creating all this human misery. Those are the real takers. But let's, you know, I know I'm being editorial here, but is that what this is all about, this idea of what the Carsons of the world are saying, that I'm an example of somebody that's made good and you guys are a bunch of parasites?
Well, to your earlier point, all too often we do find that African Americans that do become spokespersons or are held up by the Republican Party adhere to that type of narrative, that mindset. Now, I must say that prior to Ben Carson delving into the political arena, his autobiography, Golden Hands, I believe was the title, it was read within the African-American community. He was held up as a role model. I personally read his autobiography in the early 90s, and he was one of those individuals that you know, you held up and revered his accomplishments. But his latter writings and comments have been, as you said, the blaming the victim type of narrative, which is totally dismissive of the institutional, structural racism that exists in America, and that all too many African Americans and people of color are mired in. But once again, they raise up these exceptional individuals, these individuals that are perceived as being the exception rather than the rule, to say, well, it's personal responsibility, personal actions and decision-making that are causing these dire status that you find yourselves in.
Well, what do you make then of what Nancy Pelosi has said, the Democratic leader of the House Democrats? Obviously, they're in the minority even more so. But she's basically said this guy's completely unqualified, which is hardly a news flash. But what can they do? I mean, he's got to be – obviously, he's going to have hearings, you know. And by the way, he's a absolutely, you know, he can't handle journalist questions. He goes completely off the wall. I can't imagine him handling, assuming that the Democrats step up to the plate and ask him tough questions. I don't think he can handle it, can he?
Yes, I would agree. I don't know what they can do. I would imagine he will be confirmed. But this has just been a very unprecedented political season. The campaign itself, the candidates, and the ultimate president-elect, and these appointments, they defy logic once again. So at this point, America, where we're it's like Star Trek, we're going where no one has ever been. So one can only imagine what these hearings might curtail, what they might result in.
Well, obviously, the press has been unable to pin Donald Trump down on anything. You know, they never got him to release his tax returns. They never even asked him questions about why he didn't serve in the Vietnam War, which, of course, Bill Clinton was hit very hard about, and so was George W. Bush. But somehow he got a free pass on that. So, you know, none of these people have been asked any real tough questions. But the questions that Carson has been asked about the inconsistencies and some of the bizarre belief systems that he's announced, he goes very, very ballistic on and pulls his mic off and storms out. So, you know, that's what I'm anticipating, that these hearings, you know, this guy... you can make the case that Donald Trump doesn't have the temperament to be president, or, you know, he should have been anywhere near the Oval Office, let alone the nuclear button. But I think you could even make a stronger case that Dr. Ben Carson is basically, not only is he unqualified, I think he's incapable of making a case for himself.
Yes, I can't argue with you on that. As he stated when being considered for the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which I think would have been a more appropriate or closer fit for his, given his experience and expertise, or even the Surgeon General. But so, no, he's unqualified, as he stated. He's never been the head of any federal agency, so why would he now be a good selection for the Secretary of HUD? That's beyond me.
Well, Ronnie Dunn, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ronnie Dunn, who's a professor of urban studies at Cleveland State University. His research focuses on social policy, racial profiling, racial inequality, the criminal justice system, and issues affecting children and families living in urban areas and minority populations and the urban poor. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes Podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the